Welcome to Rewatchable, episode 154. We're back for Buffy the Vampire Slayer. We'll be talking about season 2, episode 17, Passion, and episode 18, Killed by Death. It's going to be fun. My name is Selena, and this week we've got super fan Karen and newbies Kristen and Mitch. Hey, guys.
Hey.
This is a new constellation. I don't think we've ever done this before.
Yeah, this is a new grouping.
Yeah,
I've never had this set of people.
I don't think we've ever had this group. This is fun. It's because usually Karen and Selena, you guys are hosting, so to have the two of you on for one episode is a pretty rare thing to have happen.
It's a unicorn in a podcast. It's great.
Yes.
I'm so excited. I'm especially excited for the Killed by Death discussion because I know Karen's planning to convince me why it's great. So stay tuned for that. Before we get into the discussion of the episode, as always, our contact information. If you want to send us your spoiler-free thoughts on this podcast or Buffy, you can email us rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. You can tweet us @re_watchable. You can find this post on hypable.com, and you can find us on Tumblr, rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com. All right, let's get into our fun facts for this week. And I'm going to let Mitch go first, so Karen and Kristen, you have time to remember what yours were.
That's probably a good idea. I think I might know some of theirs. Anyways, mine is that I saw Hamilton, I think 5 days ago now. So I've finally been able to, process it all. And I realized that Lynn and John are my new ship, the people themselves. Is it weird to ship people? Probably. It's okay. They kiss a lot.
Yeah, real person shipping is a thing, I'm sure. Well, it is. We know it is. Kristen and Karen, do you remember yours?
Can my fun fact be that I don't remember?
Sure.
Because, Kristen and I had a little drink last night, and we discussed having a fun fact and what that fun fact would be, and now neither one of us can remember. So there's my fun fact.
The hazards. And my fun fact will be that Karen and I are once again packing because we're moving again. Don't ask. It's a crazy long story. But my box of DVDs probably weighs more than a couple of small children. It's huge. And it's massive and very, very full. So, yeah, that's mine.
Do you still have a DVD player?
I have a DVD player, 2 Blu-ray players. I'm a big...
Wow, I wish I did. The other day I was going to watch a DVD and I realized I have no device on which to play a DVD. Aww. I was like, what am I going to do?
Are you
all, digital now?
All digital now, yeah. Luckily my brother has a PlayStation.
Yeah. I thought you had PlayStation 3 or 4 because you're playing The Last of Us.
Yeah, my brother... Yeah, I can play it on that if he isn't using it, so... that's kind of fun. But yes, very exciting moving plans. I started watching Battlestar Galactica again. That's kind of part of my fun facts. And it's so good. I don't know if you guys have seen it. Not that we need to talk about other shows that are good because we're talking about Buffy. But Battlestar Galactica, oh my gosh. Ugh, I love it so much. My other part of my fun fact is that I have totally contracted a sympathy fever with Buffy for Killed by Death. I'm so sick right now, guys. High on pills. Yep.
While I was watching that episode, my chest was, I feel kind of sick, too. My chest feels heavy, and I'm, clearing my throat. It's contagious through the television.
It is. Well, at least we'll see Jason Kruger coming if he comes around the corner. So,
Jason Kruger. Is that his name? I like the mix
Jason
there, Selena.
Freddy Kruger.
Freddy Kruger. Jason's Freddy the 13th.
It's funny that you mentioned
him, because I do talk about him later on in one of my favorite scenes, but not even for Killed by Death, but for Passion. So I think you're reading my mind, Selena.
Exciting. I can't wait to hear about that. But yeah, we're going to be talking about Passion, which is episode 17 of season 2 and one of the big episodes of the season, I would say. Because I am sick, I think I'm going to let Karen read the synopsis I will save you for some of my congested voice.
Okay, no problem. In this episode, Jenny Callender figures out a way to save the world using coding algorithms because she is brilliant and no one deserves her greatness. So of course, Angel has to break her neck and leave her dead body in poor, sad Giles' bed. Meanwhile, Joyce is still alive and terrible.
I object to this. We'll get into that. Thanks, Ariana, for that very short and sweet description. So yeah, I mean, guys, how are we feeling? Newbies, how are you guys feeling?
Ouch. This hurt.
Mm-hmm.
It hurt so bad. And it wasn't like I was given the opportunity to cry, because it was, like, the action kept going. Like, her neck is snapped, and it's not like... Like, you know, I kind of like how when Darla was killed, and, like, she wasn't just staked in dust. Like, she had a final word to say. It was a bit prolonged.
Mm-hmm.
No, Jenny was just killed. That was it. She, like, yeah. It was just, And then, like, you find her in the bed, and you're... I think you're just as shocked as Giles to see her in such a position. So it's not like you really have time to process it in the episode, and then the next episode keeps moving, and it's like, wow, they live in a horrible world, and I do not want to live on top of the Hellmouth.
Yeah, suddenly it got real. That's very accurate.
My reaction, like, you can ask Karen, I didn't scream or anything, because I was so in shock that that's just it. Like, I was like, Mitch, I didn't have time to really, like, comprehend what happened until afterward, and then it was like, no, like, this isn't okay. So, yeah, no, it was very, like, abrupt and very, like, on TV nowadays, like Mitch kind of mentioned, like, you get a chance to get a final word, and you know, you somehow get a chance to say goodbye, or it's at least, like, a grand scene. Like, this was so fast, and it, like, escalated from being chased, which happens every episode, to she died. And I just,
yeah,
like, it was just so incredibly unsettling and fast that, yeah, it affected me. Just not until, like, after the episode, like, when I really had time to think about it, was like, she really is gone.
Yeah. I think, Kristen, yeah. as a fellow horror fan, as far as I can tell, that you'd appreciate the fact that Buffy does a pretty good chase scene, because whenever there's, like, that... girl being chased after by the snake fraternity boys, like that scene, or like, you know, Willow running away from something, or whatever it is. It usually is very well filmed, and they're always exciting to see, because you feel like no matter what you do, the human's not going to make it out, because the supernatural element's always going to have the hand up, and I love that. I love that they feel so helpless. But it's also kind of silly, too, because there's a point where Jenny just throws, like... that cart.
Oh, the cart thing.
Why didn't she just stake him? I guess she was probably, like, panicking, but she had a broom on that thing. Is it two rounds to stake him with? Probably.
You can't really stake, like, the show kind of is weird in that way, because in the next episode, the three kids, like, just go out hunting alone without Buffy, which is, like, a way to get themselves killed. But it's pretty hard for a normal human to stake a vampire. So I'm not sure, maybe she had a chance. But you're right, she could have tried.
Or, I mean, I thought she was going to use magic. I thought, didn't you, Kristen? Like, she was going to go, I don't know, like, pull something like Amy was just doing in the Rat episode, where it can just be, like, a quick spell and whatever. Because, like, if she has magical powers, you'd think she'd be able to draw on them, even in a moment of panic. Maybe even more so because that emotion's running through her, and she'll have more power to run faster or set up a barrier for him.
She wasn't really a witch, though, was she? Like, she was a techno-pagan.
Yeah, she never really showed powers. She never really had... the ability to do magic. This whole spell thing with Angel was the first time she'd ever really shown how much she knew. So, yeah, I never really assumed she could do magic. I did catch the broom on the cart, and I was like, come on, like, you need that. Like, anything that's wooden is a potential weapon. So, yeah, I did catch that, but I was just hoping someone was going to step in, or some... you know, something was going to get in the way or something. But
did you think she was going to get a save during that chase scene? Did you think she was going to make it?
I mean, I was definitely hoping for it. I don't know if I expected it to happen, but I didn't expect her to die. So apparently I did expect some sort of save.
No, well, I was going to ask, Mitch, you said that you predicted it, didn't you?
I did. Karen, you might remember, I think I might have been on with you, when I was just like, it's only a matter of time before Jenny Calendar dies, because on a supernatural show like this, when you have a B character that is a love interest of a main character, that main character will either kill them or be tragically depressed because their love interest dies. It's the way that these shows work to continue the drama so that the main characters can stay alive, but we still have high-stakes drama. And it didn't make it any easier, I'll give you that much, because I think I knew it was coming when she started running. Like, once he and you know, even when he shattered the soul ball, when he threw that, I was like, this is it. Like, she's not making it out of this at all.
And obviously, we'll get more into Jenny later, and we'll talk about whether or not, like, because in a lot of ways, Buffy started this trend with Jenny Calendar. We'll talk about that when we get to that scene. But I think we should move a little bit back to the beginning of the episode here, and I really want to get your thoughts on the opening and closing monologues of Angel talking about passion. Because I thought, I that gets me every time. I think that makes it, like, 10 times more epic.
I feel like I was watching Grey's Anatomy.
Okay. That makes it less epic, I guess.
It was to me, because, I mean, I just think of, like, Meredith Grey saying things like, love, it's what keeps us going. Mm. Every day we wake up and we have it.
Oh, that's true.
It felt just like what she would say.
Do that? They did that for the first, like, 5 seasons.
Like, I'm pretty sure they took this passions monologue and closing monologue. I'm pretty sure they took that from, like, a Valentine's Day episode of Grey's Anatomy.
See, yeah. I didn't love his overplay, but I didn't hate it either. I just kind of said, wow, Angel, like, narrating over this episode is really weird. Like, it stuck out to me. And I was like, why? Like, I get kind of why, but I also was like, it's an interesting choice for an episode in which his passion rocks the world of everybody else. Like, for some reason, it never really sat perfectly right with me. But it was an interesting choice, for sure.
What do you feel about it, Karen?
I loved it, actually. I don't watch Grey's Anatomy, so I can't make any comparisons there, and it didn't make it feel silly or anything. Actually, it makes it feel really personal for me when you have Angel narrating it, and you kind of see it from his point of view. Not that you sympathize with what he's doing, but it just, I don't know, it makes it so much creepier in my mind.
I agree. I mean, I really agree, and I think what brings it home for me, and we'll get to that later as well, but is that scene with the phone, with the voiceover, where we get back to passion, you know, it's what makes you feel alive, and, you know, you're destroyed, whatever he says when he's looking at Buffy through the window, and then I feel like, oh, you know, it's kind of like, oh, this episode is about something, like, it's not just an episode in which something happens, it's actually, like, a theme, obviously. Duh, it's a title. But so I will say I like it. But I can see it's a lot of stuff with Buffy I feel like we're going to be saying in the next 2 years. We're going to be like, yeah, this happens a lot now, but back then it was really original. It's going to sound like a broken record, guys. Just be warned. So in this episode, we also have, obviously, a lot of stuff with Giles and Buffy and Buffy's mom and how Buffy still isn't telling Joyce the truth about her being a Slayer, which obviously leads to a very awkward moment when Angelus confronts Buffy's mom. Ariana has a question in the doc that asks, why does Giles not want Buffy to tell Joyce that she's a Slayer? And I was wondering, the newbies, what you guys feel like. If you feel like it makes sense, or if it just feels like a made-up plot thing.
It doesn't make sense to me. It feels like a plot device just to keep her out of the loop. But I don't even know what that plot device earns. What is the point of not telling Joyce at this point? It would only help. And maybe that's coming. Like, maybe Joyce is going to die one day, and they're going to be like, Mom, I should have told you sooner. There's, like, vampires everywhere. Saws. And then she's like, it's okay. I'll die in peace now, knowing the truth about our lives, and then that'll be it.
Yeah, maybe. I think it makes sense, but I'm not totally sure if it makes sense in retrospect for me, or if it makes sense as I'm watching it now. But I think, you know, considering the kind of relationship or lack of relationship that Buffy and Joyce have, I don't see a scenario in which Buffy could just go up to her and be like, yeah, I'm the Slayer, I'm going to go slay vampires now. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like she's right to keep this world from her mother.
She's only going to get her mom killed in the end, because she's talking to Angel, and she should have known that Angel was a vampire by now. I mean, what more is there to it? He's stalking them. I don't get why Buffy feels the need to listen to Giles. I mean, I think she takes initiative in other things in her life, and for some reason she seems to not take initiative here. I don't see the benefit. If she's so easy to tell Joe Schmo from her old school, or I guess he knew, but she was just so cool with it when he knew, and then she just basically lets Cordelia into their Scooby gang, and that's whatever. But then her mom, it's like, oh God, no. It's like the more you know Buffy, the least apt she is to tell you the truth about her life, which makes no sense to me, because I don't think that makes sense as a character. I think she tries to keep her close friends and family so that she can have strong connections, and then she could be, like Spike describes, like a stronger slayer for that.
I'm kind of two minds, because, yes, I want Joyce to know, because I feel like it would help Buffy and her to be on the same page. Like, right now, Joyce just thinks Buffy's sneaking out to do crazy teenage things, whereas Buffy's sneaking out to do something for the greater good of mankind and save the world. So, like, I feel like it could do good things for their relationship, but I also see why, especially up until now, Giles hasn't wanted Buffy to tell her. It's ultimately, so far, nobody has really been an open threat to Joyce. Like, up until Angel, nobody has openly been, you know, been using Joyce as a piece against Buffy. So there's been no real reason to tell her. Small things have happened, but she's been able to play them off. Now, Joyce is in, like, mortal danger because Angel knows that he can use her against Buffy. So now, I kind of think maybe Joyce should know. Maybe it's finally time. But, you know, I can also see why Giles is a little unsure of whether to tell Joyce or not.
Kristen, yeah, what about when Darla, like, almost killed Joyce just to make a point that Angel could still be bad in Buffy's eyes? Or then, I mean, I guess you could say everything else that's happened with, like, the mind control things we don't talk about anymore. Hashtag don't talk about the eggs. And then things like, you know, the Xander Love episode. It feels like it would make sense to tell her something supernatural is happening in Sunnydale. We should probably move. But now Buffy's probably too invested in her friends. And I don't know. It's weird to me. I don't really understand what's going on. Because before Buffy was at the Hellmouth, were all these creatures just roaming free? And was the town just like, was the population decreasing quicker than it could increase? Or did Buffy's arrival bring about more supernatural elements to happen? I'm not really sure on that. But I feel like if that's the case, if she was to leave, it would all stop. So,
no, I mean, they've explained that the reason Buffy was drawn to Sunnydale, which is kind of what they're saying happened, was because the town needed a slayer at this particular time. You know, it's obviously on top of a hellmouth, but the activity was really increasing because of the master. No? Yes.
Yes, master.
Too many monsters. The master. And now, obviously, we have also seen that vampires seem to kind of spring up around Buffy, too. And because it's a Hellmouth, she's a slayer. She's needed on the Hellmouth. But if she went away, the evil stuff wouldn't go away because Sunnydale is still a Hellmouth. So she needs to be there to basically guard the mouth of hell, essentially, is what her task is, right? But I think for your question, though, Mitch, about Joyce, I mean, I think it comes down to two things, really, and one of them we should talk about in more depth because it relates to that cringeworthy the talk scene. For Buffy, a lot of her motivation is about keeping her life as quote-unquote normal as she possibly can. Like, she knows she's the Slayer, and she knows she has this great responsibility, but she also knows, like, she wants to be a teenage girl. She wants to go out with boys, and she wants to go to parties. And she's always talking about how, oh, you know, I want to do normal things. And I think for Buffy, the more she can keep her life contained, the more she can maintain that illusion of being normal. And I think her mother, for her, and this, Karen, feel free to contradict me on this, but I feel like one of the reasons that she's so intent on keeping it from her parents and everyone she can is because it becomes less real. Like, she can compartmentalize that part of her life when she goes home. She doesn't have to talk to her mom about it, you know?
Yeah, I absolutely feel that way. Also, and I hate the trope of, like, the superhero having to keep their identity secret from those close to them to protect them, because it gets really old really fast, and most of the time it doesn't protect them anyway. But in this case, I feel like Buffy also doesn't want to tell her mom, because if her mom knows the truth, she's going to freak out and she's going to try to protect Buffy and keep her from doing what needs to be done, and that's going to hold Buffy back. Like, unfortunately, but her mom is still her mom and is always going to want to protect her. I think it's, in this case, smarter for her not to.
Right. And then the other part of it, which I really want to get into, is, and this is going to be a fun discussion, because the scene where Buffy and Joyce have the talk after Angelus has spilled the beans, which is still better than him killing her. I mean, let's get real. Joyce now knows that Buffy and Angel had sex, and they want to talk about it. And Ariana writes, Joyce flips a crap about not knowing anything about Buffy's life, even though she never tries to talk to Buffy about her life. And I know that you guys, like the newbies, like you kind of feel this way about Joyce in general. But my counter to that would be, I feel like this really gives Joyce, it gives us an insight into what's going on in Joyce's head. I don't know if you guys like have been that kind of teenager or if you've known that kind of teenagers that just do not let their parents into their lives. Like, they shut them out, they lock themselves in their room, they go places and they don't tell their parents about it, they get into trouble and the parents don't know what's going on. From Joyce's perspective, she has a really messed up teenage daughter, and she's like grasping at straws to get her daughter to tell her anything. And now she finds out that not only did she have a boyfriend she didn't tell her about, but she also had sex with this boyfriend, and Joyce never knew. And I feel so bad for Joyce. I don't know about you guys, but I really feel for her.
I think it was it Joyce who said, you were close enough with him to sleep with a boy you never even told me you were dating, or something like right. that. And it's such a good line, because up until then, we're watching the show, and so it's hard for us to separate what characters know what, but mm-hmm. Joyce doesn't know about Angel. Like, Joyce no. has no idea. So it's really, really hard to put yourself in Joyce's mindset, where she's never seen this kid. She has no idea who it is.
Yeah, she's like, your study buddy.
Right. And then all of a sudden, bam, they've been dating and they slept together. And what is happening? Like, I can see where Joyce is coming from a little bit. Yeah. Like, I always kind of felt like Joyce didn't try. But again, if you remember all of the things that have gone on in Buffy's life, and they had to move here because she burnt down a gymnasium. Like, she's been a troublesome child, if you see it from the outside. You know, she's an at-risk youth or whatever. So right. Joyce is just doing her best to try and bring Buffy back around. And
without alienating her completely, yeah.
Right. Maybe she thinks giving her some space and not trying to be in her hair 24/7 is the way to do it. And so learning now that that isn't working, and that Buffy's doing things behind her back that she didn't think she was up to. I kind of see where Joyce is coming from. It's not necessarily the truth. There's a lot more going on than Joyce knows. Yeah,
exactly. Joyce doesn't know any of that. Like, they have this great line that I put in the doc where Buffy goes, like, I can't tell you everything. And Joyce says, how about anything? And you're like, oh, yeah, what the hell does Joyce even know? I felt like that moment got really real, and I really appreciated it.
But I, and I feel like it was a pretty big moment about what happens in this conversation with Joyce, because she tells Buffy immediately after Joyce and Buffy are threatened by Angel, why don't you have better judgment in boys? She's more concerned about, like, punishing Buffy and teaching her a lesson than protecting her.
I don't think she was punishing her and teaching her a lesson, though. Like, I don't know if I just read that scene, like, but Joyce trying to keep a level head and trying not to freak out at Buffy and trying to keep the conversation on a level where they could both, you know, like, she just wants a connection to Buffy, and that's what she was trying to do. Like, she was so angry, but she was also like, please tell me stuff. You know,
I don't think Joyce was angry at Buffy for sleeping with Angel. I really mm-hmm. don't think that was it. I think she was angry exactly. that Buffy had a boyfriend she was so serious about that she would lose her virginity, and Joyce had no idea. Like, right. I think that's more the frustration for her in that scene. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think she was yelling at Buffy. It was like, how do I get across that I want to know my daughter? Without being the controlling parent.
Yeah, I don't know, but it's interesting. It's always interesting to hear people's reactions on Joyce, because a lot of people don't like her. But I don't know. I definitely feel her part in this. Oh, well, we can talk about that some other week, I'm sure. I want to talk about Jenny, you guys.
Ugh.
First, she saves everyone. She figures it out. She has a spell. She goes to the magic shop and she finds the Orb of Thessala, and she works out the curse, and everything is good. And even Buffy Jenny and Giles kind of work it out, because Buffy kind of has that half conversation with Jenny, and everything just seems so good there for 5 minutes. I'm so sad. They were so close to happiness.
Yeah.
Any thoughts? Were you happy? Yes.
I think that's what makes this episode even more heart-wrenching, is because everybody's sort of building themselves back up after Angel has turned, and things are looking so much better. There's so much hope. Mm. And especially with her figuring out the program and everything, like, you're like, yes, it's all going to be fine. We can get over this nightmare. And then it's ripped away. And just everything about this is so tragic. And yet I love it so much. Like, that sounds like I'm a crazy person, but this episode is one of those episodes that just sticks with you forever. Yeah. And I think a lot of it has to do with the horror of it, but also, like we were talking about earlier, the way that Jenny dies, like, it's so quick and you can't even comprehend it at first. And then it gets worse. You're like, how can it get worse after she's already killed? But it does, 100-fold. And even that moment of the floppy disk falling between the tables just burned into my brain. I don't know why, but I think it's just that hope slipping out of your grasp, and you're like, how are they ever going to fix this?
I know. And that's part of the importance of this episode. I feel like it's just, and I think Joss Whedon said the same thing, that this was about showing how real of a threat Angel is and how permanent of a threat he is. Like, there's no easy fix for this. This isn't a good thing. And this isn't just him running around being a bully. This is him legitimately slowly ruining Buffy's life. And that comes into the way he killed Jenny, too. You know, he didn't even bite her. He just snapped her neck. That's how easy it was. And that's how fast it was to get rid of this hugely important person in everybody's lives. I think for me, and I think that the power of this episode, too, is not necessarily just the chase and the death, as horrible as those were, and as many nightmares as they gave me when I was 13, but it's the scenes that come after, you know. It's the scene in Giles's apartment is obviously horrendous. That mix of the opera music and the roses and the body in the bed and Giles's face. Like, Anthony Stewart had this performance in that scene. Oh my gosh. Newbies, what did you guys feel about that scene?
It felt like The Godfather to me, because I think that they often haven't seen those movies properly, like, ever. Just, like, on TV a little bit.
Okay. You know?
But it felt like The Godfather, and then I remember seeing a lot of scenes with, like, opera music and, like, horrific things happening in the background. I wonder which came first, Buffy or The Godfather movies. I'm not
pretty
sure.
The Godfather did.
Did it?
That was, like, the 80s, right?
I wonder if this is meant to be kind of, like, you know, a little bit of that in here. And I thought it was beautiful because of that, because I thought it was a great call out to what's apparently a great piece of media, one that I still haven't seen all the whole way, but I can appreciate that it's good.
But it reminded me so much of that thing I haven't seen.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's exactly how Buffy describes it. It's the wrapping for the gift, and it's twisted and creepy that, yeah, like, you know the whole time what's awaiting him. Like, you just know. He walks in, you see the same color paper that he's used for Buffy, you know, with all of her little the drawings and things. And you see the champagne and the candles, and it looks like this, you know, glorious thing since Jenny and him were just talking about, like, you know, kind of getting back together, like getting back on the same page. And you know that there's this horrible thing waiting for him. When he gets up there and sees that she's dead, you just can't. To go from Giles being so excited to see Jenny and what this night could mean for them to exactly all of the horrors that this night is now, you see it on his face. It's a really, really disturbing and creepy scene. But really
such
well
a strong
done.
Performance. Yeah, so well. Like, I'm amazed every time I watch that scene. I almost can't watch it. It's kind of like Mitch and The Godfather, you know, I just catch it out of the corner of my eye.
The cuts are like, he's looking at the body. It kind of goes back and forth between him looking at it and his face in shock, and then the body. And then it just cuts to a different angle. And for a second, I thought, this is still within the same, you know, period of time. No, he'd already called the police. There were lights flashing on in the background. And that just shows that he was just in such utter shock that he can't even function. And, like, it's almost like his mind skipped forward and ours did, too, because we didn't want to focus on that death anymore.
Right. And that's, like, one of the brilliant things about Angel Angelus is, I want to call him Angelus because it's not Angel, it's Angelus. The length to which he will go to destroy Buffy is not for Buffy. Like, this is what he's done this to undo Giles. You know, this is all a setup to destroy Giles because he wants to take Giles away from Buffy by killing Jenny. Like, instead of just killing Buffy or killing all her friends, like, he's doing it like this. And that makes it so scary because you're like, what the hell is going to happen next? And once again, you're thinking, thank God none of them have puppies. And thank God, you know, as sad as I was for those fish, we'll get to those, I guess. So from that scene with Giles, we cut to the one where Buffy and Willow get the message. And for me, I feel this is, you know, spoiler alert, this is my favorite scene of the episode. This is the one that gets me every time I watch this episode, because like the death is terrible. The one where he finds her is like horrific. But when they get the call and Willow cries, I cry. Like, I feel like this is a common thing, Karen. When Willow cries, we cry.
Every time. I can't, like, yeah. I know it's coming. I watched this twice within the last week. And so, like, it was already fresh in my mind. Every time she cries, my eyes just well up. And I'm like, keep it together.
She's the best crier. Like, Allison Hannigan is just... Jared Weiselman, who, by the way, you guys cannot follow because he posts Buffy spoilers all the time. But he's, like, this reporter from... I don't even know where he's from, but I follow him on Twitter. And he, like, posted a happy birthday message to Allison Hannigan. He was, like, celebrating the best crier on television, like, a couple of days ago. I was like, oh, yeah! This proves it. This very episode is, like, one of her first big cries, and it's so good. And again, you know, Kristen, you were talking about how it all happened so fast. And I feel like it does. Like, you're still in shock. You're like, did that just happen? Did Buffy just kill off its first, like, this is the biggest character, not counting Buffy herself, this is the biggest character they've killed so far, like, or maybe ever. Who knows? And then you get to that scene, and you see them go from happy to sad, and maybe you, like, you've experienced something similar in your own life, and it's so real. You get away from all the supernatural stuff and all the drama, and you just get that real moment of seeing them destroyed. And I just,
addition to Willow crying and you wanting to cry, Angel is sitting outside the window with the biggest smirk on his face. Yeah. Like, it's the scariest part of the episode, is he is so blissfully happy that he's done all this.
You know, he feeds on their passion. Just like,
it's so hard to identify with it because, hello, it's completely inhuman. But, like, you're sitting there watching him and you're like, how is he happy? Like, of course he's happy, but how is he happy? Like, you know, and it.
This is the monster of Angelus. Yeah, you're right. This is his passion. This is what he feeds on from these people. And this is what makes him such a scary, scary, scary villain. And 100 times scarier than Spike, who wouldn't even eat a damn puppy. I mean, it's like, like Aliana said, like, Drew and Spike are so bad at being vampires. And like, it's so true. But so, yeah, I mean, and Ariana, she has a lot of like all caps notes because she's so like upset about Jenny. And I think like we all are super upset about Jenny. And she says, like, I will never get over this. And I think, you know, this is sort of unanimous to all people who have ever watched Buffy. Like Karen said, this is one of those things that just sticks with you. And as I sort of alluded to, and obviously we want to move on, but I just really quickly want to bring up that Jenny's death in this way, in a genre show of this type, it really, I think, set the stage for a lot of stuff that happens on TV today. And, you know, we're talking about The 100, and we're talking about all these different fandoms that just kind of kill off characters and audiences. This is obviously for a very different reason, but audiences today are very critical of shows that kill characters just to kill them. And Mitch, you said, you know, oh, they always kill love interests because it's like the thing to do. But back then, it really wasn't the thing to do. You know, killing a character like Jenny, even though she wasn't a main character, I feel like it shocked the Buffy fandom. That's such a lighthearted, you know, la 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 vampire slayer show would do something as gruesome as this. Fans at the time were not prepared for it, and the actors weren't prepared for it because Joss Whedon was kind of like, I wanted to prove to them that they could die anytime. And that happens on TV shows all the time now, but it really didn't then.
Yeah. That's pretty cruel, because I feel like that was, like, proof that that could happen, but it also started to feel like it was too quick of a tonal shift for me, because all of a sudden, we go from kind of, like, this gushy love story of Buffy and Angel and all this, and it feels like no one important is going to die, and everyone kind of gets away, like, Spike doesn't even die underneath the being crushed from the organ and whatnot. It feels like everyone just kind of gets away. And all of a sudden, Jenny just gets killed so brutally. And it's not just like, It's not like a heroic death. It's not like one that's prolonged, like we're saying, like where she has a bit of a moment to say goodbye or something. It was just so like second gear all of a sudden. And I can go with this. I want to know if it's going to stay to this level. If we're going
to see
this kind of intensity going on.
Right. Well, honestly, that's I think what it was trying to do. And obviously, like, you're watching it again, you're watching it 20 years later with a lot more TV development since then, so your perception is going to be skewed by that, but it was meant as a tonal shift. It's been scary for a while, but crap has gotten real, and this was sort of meant to signify, signal again that Angel isn't just la-la-la evil in the background, like Stefan style, you know, like he's legitimately there to hurt them, and no one is safe. And again, for a show like this, the message, no one is safe, was really jarring to audiences. And this is one of the reasons why this is one of the episodes that got people really hooked, because they were like, oh my God, there are stakes. Both kinds of stakes. So yeah, next week they'll go to a steakhouse and make it a three steak way. I feel, I don't know where that went. I'm sick, guys. I can't help it. But no, really though, I mean, and again, if you feel like it was too abrupt and you feel too removed by it, then that's one thing. But I think it really, what this is what Buffy does well. It mixes humor with horror, with genuine tragedy. Like, you're not just going to kill off characters at random. You know, you're not just, it's not like a show about killing lots of people, but it is a show about tapping into a true emotion of its viewers. But I wonder, like, Kristen, do you feel like it tapped into that all caps emotion, or are you kind of more removed from it like Mitch?
In the moment, I wasn't. Everything happened so fast, especially with her actual death scene, that I wasn't fully, like, participating in it, because I was, it took me by surprise. But by the end of the episode, I was there with Buffy and Willow. Oh my God, like, she really is gone, and how is this going to affect Giles and everything else? So I don't know if I was fully ready for the emotional upheaval, because I know others had incredibly strong emotional ties to this episode, but looking back on it and watching it a second time, I'm sure I would have more emotional reaction to it than I did.
Do you remember your reaction, Karen, when you watched it?
It was so much about that hope being taken away. And right. I think that's why that little, you know, scene of the floppy disk falling is just seared into my brain, because everything was building up to this hopeful, you know, we can get Angel's soul back, it's all going to be fine. And then it's ripped away from you because you still care about Angel. Like, yeah, right now, he's a jerk, and you're like, I kind of want him to die because he's terrible, but also Angel was a good guy before. If we can save him, that would be a lot better. And that hope is within reach. I mean, it's in Jenny's hands. And then, you know, she looks up and Angel's just chilling in her classroom, and you're like, this is not going to go well. I don't think it's her death that stays with you, because like we've said, it's so quick, but it's the consequences of that death that just makes it so painful.
That's a really good point. I'm glad you brought that up, because I feel like we've talked about this before, and again, we need to move on soon. I don't want to move on from Jenny, but but that's the thing about Buffy. It's not necessarily, this is going to sound dumb, but it's not how the stuff that happens affects you that affects you. It's how it affects the characters that affect you. Like, we talked about Willow crying. Like, the thing Buffy does so well is that what happens really happens to these characters. And if the show has done its job right, and if you get into it when you watch it, like, you feel what these characters are feeling. And that's what this episode did, you know? It made it about everyone else's reactions to Jenny's death. And everyone else's reactions to Angel as a threat and all of that stuff, you know? And that, for me, that's what makes it feel so real and hits so much harder than just, oh, a character I like died, you know?
And by making her death so abrupt and quick, it does put the focus on everything else.
Yeah.
In any other show, the focus is on the death, and you're, you know, you're watching this elaborate death scene and all of that. But by making it so abrupt, it does put the emphasis on everybody else.
Yeah, exactly. So what else have we got? We've got, of course, that thing. I always think it's the end of the episode, her death. But of course, there's a whole big thing after where Giles goes to single-handedly kill Angel, which, first of all, good job, Giles. And I noted, too, that Spike almost lets him. Like, Spike is just done with Angel at this point. I love that so much. Yeah. Like,
That scene is great. From the flaming baseball bat to Spike pulling Drew back to Angel, like, actually looking concerned for a second. Like, hey, wait a minute. This guy kind of means business. Like, it's a great scene.
When it comes to the point, too, in this episode where it feels like, wow, there's going to be so much, like, humongous action. When's it going to end? Not in a bad way. It's not like, oh, this is so long. It's like, oh, my God, how much can they pack into an episode? I don't know if my little heart can handle it.
Exactly. I noticed that too upon rewatching after such a long distance between viewings. It's like her death, her actual death, comes about halfway through the episode. And then you have this scene of her in the bed, which is like so pivotal. And then even after that, you have Giles attacking Angel. Yeah. And it feels like, wow, you know, a lot of other shows would have put her death as like the end cliffhanger. And then, oh my gosh, we have to wait for next week for the consequences. They don't let you wait. You have to, like, be inundated with everything immediately after. And I think that's another reason why this episode sticks with you, is because you don't get that break in between.
Right. And for the minute there, it kind of looks like you're going to lose Giles, too, you know, which I always think is terrifying. Like, obviously, you know that he'll be fine. I don't know if you know he'll be fine. I don't know if you guys, newbies, if you were ever worried for him.
At that point, it's hard to believe they would take Giles and Jenny in the same episode. So I don't think I was ever actually worried for him. But, you know, and he comes in so badass that it's hard to believe he's going to, like, end the scene dead. Like, I'm sorry, it just never occurred.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Yeah, and I know you have that later, so we'll save that. But, oh, Giles. But then, and we end with that scene with Buffy and Giles embracing and crying, and Buffy being like, I can't do this without you.
The way
and
she punches them.
Oh, God, yeah.
Because it's like
Buffy's
so...
way of showing affection.
Right, because she's just, because he's being a dork, and then she's just like, bam, what are you doing? Yeah. I can't do this without you.
Knocks some sense into you, yeah, that's, but I just, I mean, I've said before that Buffy and Giles is my favorite relationship on the show, and I just, that moment just brought it home for me, like, or not in relationship, you know what I mean, like dynamic on the show. And I just, that scene, guys, it's so good. So good. All of it's just so good. Let's move into our favorite scenes. The phone call scene, that was mine. I'm not going to talk about it more. I just want to emphasize that I loved it so much. And it will forever make me cry. Karen, speaking of crying.
Yeah, it's so hard because my favorite scene is when Giles finds Jenny in his bed, not because I like it,
it's but so good.
It is, but it is so good. Like you said before, the swelling of the music and everything's so romantic, and then there's just this dead body. And I think it's even worse that, like, she's not covered in blood, she isn't stabbed through the heart, like, she's just lying there with her eyes open. And you can't even really tell that she's dead except for she's clearly not moving.
Right.
And that is just, I don't know, it evokes so much in you that I can't help but love it for giving me that much emotion and making me care so much about these characters.
Mm-hmm. Mitch, what about you? Sort of moving back in time now.
Right. Well, as I was saying to you before, Selena, you were referencing, I think, Jason from
Jason
Friday the 13th.
Kruger.
Jason Kruger. Jason is known for his slow walk in the Friday the 13th movies, and that's kind of like a fun thing that Angel is doing here, because he almost wanted to like start speed walking at a point, you can tell, and that's kind of what Jason does too, when he doesn't want the person to get too far away. But they know, always, like, the Jason in the scenario always knows that their villain, that their victim is a little bit panicked. They're not going to get away very easily because they're going to trip over their own feet and they're not going to be able to lock the door the right way or whatever it is. And it's really scary when this happens because it's kind of like a nightmare that I always have. I think it's probably from Friday the 13th that something is like slowly chasing after me and I can't run fast enough away from it. And I think it's even more terrifying with it going slow because you're like, oh, it should be easier, but no, it's not.
Right. I was actually going to ask if any of you guys felt like this scene was reminiscent of Scream, like, is particularly the opening scene of the first Scream movie, where
Drew Barrymore,
she's so close, yeah, she's so close to escaping, and like that horrifying scene when she's right outside the house.
What's your favorite scary
and they always
movie?
Oh my god, like, oh god, like, I think that scene, like, because I've taken a bunch of script writing classes, and in every single class they show that scene, and every time I'm like, not again, like, oh, I hate it so much, it's so scary. And this is a lot like that, like, she's almost away, and then boom, he gets her, and
I know,
and that makes it worse.
Karen's
so
seen
close.
Scream too, and I think, yeah, That's disturbing, isn't it, in the beginning? It's a good way to start off both a TV show and a movie series about Scream. I'll give you that much, because it's really effective, and it did a good job here, too. I think that the slow walk is always what is always going to get me.
Yeah. God. And, Kristen, how about you? You have some better, some more lighthearted ones.
Yeah. First of all, them angel-proofing Willow's house was adorable. The episode is so dramatic that having those little moments where she, like, talks about hanging crucifixes in, you know, her dad's house, like, it's so cute. So I love that scene. But Giles being a badass, I think, is the one that really wins for me. You know, he's so full of this need for vengeance. Like, he's going to take Angel down for what he did. And so he doesn't, you know, take it to Buffy or anything. He just goes in swinging, literally, with a bat on fire. And it's amazing. So, I really, really love Giles and his, like, I'm going to be a badass moment.
Yes. And Brittany's going to appreciate you saying that too, so that's good. And my favorite lines now, I picked one from Jenny and Giles just because I feel like I'm sad, so I want to pick them. And Jenny tries to reconcile with Giles, and she goes, "I know you feel betrayed." And Giles goes, "Well, that's one of the unpleasant side effects of being betrayed." It's sad now, but I laughed at the time, so there you go.
And he doesn't even say it like angrily necessarily. He's just kind of like points it out.
Wisecracking. He's thinking around Xander too much. So Karen, what's yours?
Speaking of Xander, one of the other funny threads throughout this episode was Cordelia being so concerned about her car. She wants to make sure that Angel isn't gonna attack her in her car and everything like that, and Xander just tells her, "Yep, you're doomed to having to give him and his vamp pals a lift whenever they feel like it." And those guys never chip in for gas. And I mean, leave it to Xander to make a kind of serious situation just absolutely ridiculous. But, you know, her over-concern for her car was a little like, come on, Cordelia. There are priorities.
I love that was a recurring theme, too. Like, I kept coming back up that she was more and more concerned every time. Like, he's going to enter my car. That car really counts as, like, I don't know, like a house or a...
I know! That always was weird to me. Like, I don't get it. Why can you be invited into someone's car? Anyway, that's a different discussion for a different time. Kristen, what's your line?
Mine also comes from Xander. He had just, like, talked to Giles and had boiled down Angel's, like, taunting of Buffy to a na-na-na-na-na form of villainism. And so Buffy kind of does the same thing, and Xander says, "Hey, how come Buffy doesn't get a snotty? Once again, you boil it down to the simplest form thing, Watcher's pet." And the Watcher's pet line is my favorite part of that. Like, she is the Watcher's pet, but that's kind of the point.
I feel like there used to be a fan site called Watcher's Pet. I'm sure I used to visit that back in the pre-YouTube days. Yeah, that was a good one. And Mitch, what's yours?
Mine is Cordelia's super daft line of, "Willow, are you aware that there are no fish in your aquarium?" And then Willow just whimpers.
Way to make it worse.
Yeah, and then Buffy's just like, you gotta get out of here. You're good. Just, what, bye.
Shout out to the fish scene, though, which we didn't really talk too much about, but that gets me every time, because every time she's feeding her fish, I don't think to look in the tank for the fact that there are no fish in there, and then, you know, she pulls them out on the string, and the camera goes to the other side of the fish tank, and you're watching it through the fish tank. Just excellent. Excellent little, like, mini story within the episode, and it's just...
Isn't that horrifying? Ugh. Like, the thinking of, like, the fish being strung makes me more horrified than even Jenny Calendar having her naps.
Oh, my God.
Because it's so terrifying, because at least she had a quick death. These things didn't. It's just so bad. What do these little fish do? Nothing.
You're right. We should be vegetarians. This is awful.
I mean, we're still not over the pig, and I'm going to add on the fish to that list of animals we're still not over.
Yeah. I love it. Keep it going for sure. In season 5, it'll be the cow killing season. It'll be great.
Perfect.
That was also, I mean, that fish scene again gives me creeps every time. So RIP the fish and RIP Jenny. Very sad. Now, the next episode, I'm probably not going to be talking too much about that because I don't like it very much. But I have a feeling that Karen can convince me otherwise. So we'll see how that goes. It's Killed by Death, and the short synopsis. Karen, do you want to read it again?
Sure. In this episode, Buffy is hospitalized with the flu when she finds out that a terrifying invisible Dementor man is literally sucking the life out of sick kids. In the end, she beats him up until he's dead.
Yes, once again, short and sweet. That pretty much sums up what happens. First of all, I posted this on Twitter too, so I'm sure you guys all, I'm sure you guys all saw my Twitter feed. No, maybe you've seen it, maybe not. But this episode, one of the reasons why I'm not particularly a huge fan of it, and I tend to skip it on rewatch actually, is because it originally was planned as a season one episode. I don't know if it was because it was a shorter season they anticipated, or they just they were like discarded ideas and they were like, oh, let's get this one for a filler or whatever. It feels very out of place to me. Like, after all this Jenny drama, there's like a, I don't want to call it a bottle episode, but it's kind of what it is. Like, takes place within a hospital and Angelos is like hardly in it at all. And I'm very curious how the newbies felt. If you noticed at all that was jarring, or if you just took it in stride. We're like, that's another bad eggs type situation.
As much of a fan of like the whole slasher thing as I can be, because I don't mind a good slasher movie. I hate creepy horror with spirits and demons and all that. I can't do it. I can't watch them. They disturb me too much. I just can't. So this episode, honest to God, hated it because the guy is really creepy. Like, it's not like the werewolf suit where you can kind of like pass it off. It's kind of ridiculous. Like, no, this guy is legit creepy. And
but you didn't hate it because it was bad, right? You hated it because it was scary, or?
Well, I couldn't watch most of it because he was legitimately scary. Like, I'm not even kidding. It freaked me out. But in addition to that, I don't necessarily think that it raised the stakes. Passion is this big episode that has changed the show and changed how they're going to do business from here on out. And then you get this episode that just kind of pulls you back to, okay, now we've got a monster to fight and Buffy's going to do it and here we go.
Yeah.
So it didn't really affect me. It's not a great episode and I will probably never watch it again, but you know, it did. I hated the creepiness of that guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Mitch, how did you feel about this one?
I don't think I would ever rewatch this one simply for the eye suckers, because that's not okay.
Right. That's true. That is a faux pas in television. That's awful. No, it's funny you guys say that, because like I personally don't have a problem necessarily with the monster or the hospital or any of that stuff, but I don't rewatch this one. I think it's one you can skip. But actually, when I watched it this time, I was like, actually there are some pretty good moments, especially for Cordelia. You know, it's a good episode for Cordy, and we're gonna get into talking about that. So Karen, I'm very excited to hear what you have to say.
I feel like I have this reputation for liking terrible things. So, well, I do have a reputation for liking terrible things.
Yeah.
Which is fine. I really like monster movies, and this just reminds me of those kind of movies. But the reason why I like this episode is actually because I think it ties in really well with the previous one. It's definitely not on the same level. Like, I'm not even going to pretend it's anywhere close to Passion. But I like that they continue to string, first of all, Jenny's death throughout this episode, and like the threat of Angel, and especially the idea that Buffy is now too weak to even handle Angel. I mean, he could have killed her, except her friends were there. And I think it kind of shows you, one, that Buffy needs her friends, and two, that she's not always the superhero. Like, sometimes she's going to be weak and sometimes she's going to need help. And I like seeing that vulnerable side to her, because it's kind of always a given that, like, she can punch a hole through a wall and stuff like that. But when we see her sort of normal, I think there are a lot of stakes involved. Not as high as Passion, of course, but it kind of gives you a different side to that story. The other reason why I like this is because of the monster we see. I really like stories of invisible monsters that only certain people can see, because it's terrifying. There could be some scary monster in my room right now that I just can't see, and maybe I'll die.
Okay.
I think it's really interesting, and the way that they kind of make it out to be the doctor at first, like, you're convinced it's going to be the doctor, and then he becomes one of the victims, is a really good twist on that story. And the other thing is, the villain is just actually scary. Like, there are, like Kristen was saying, a lot of ridiculous villains and antagonists in the show, because it is from the 90s, and you know, they don't have the same kind of special effects as we do now, but this one scares me every time, between the teeth and the face and the way that he like bows and, like, you know, tips his hat and his eyeball suckers. This just gives me the creeps.
Yeah, I mean, and again, you're absolutely right. And I will say, because maybe this is why I might come off as not liking Buffy as much as I do, because I'm so intent on pointing out the few things I don't like. But I do feel like rewatching it, season two, because season one is so short. But it's also like a transition season. You're waiting for them to find their footing and stuff. Season two, sometimes I'm rewatching it now, I'm thinking, if that had been like half as long, oh my God. Like, would it? It's easy to say now because all shows do like half seasons. Back then, they had to fill up like 20 something episodes. And I think Buffy gets a lot better at it as it goes on. But it's like every time an episode comes up that isn't directly related to our central conflict, I'm like, oh, but the monster, like, but Angel, like, how is it, like, it takes me a little bit out of it, because I feel like Angelus is such a big threat, and they've just killed Jenny, that putting Buffy in the hospital and having Sander in the corridor, like, oh, well, what are you going to do? There are, like, three doctors over there. You can't kill me. Like, that's, no, he can easily kill everyone. Like, this is when Angelus would kill another one of her friends, or, like, I don't know, chop off Sander's arm or something. Like, I don't know. So it just takes me out of the threat of Angelus a little bit. But what I will say is that for this one, like every other episode of Buffy so far, it has some fantastic character moments. And I just want to bring it back to Cordelia again and Sander as well, because Buffy's sort of out of commission and dealing with her. This is Freddy Krueger, not his cousin Jason. Sander and Cordelia, they get a lot of focus time, and Cordelia gets to help out with solving the mystery, and she has so many zingers, and she's wearing this really cool green jumper that I for some reason remember, and I really appreciate that. And I wonder what newbies, like, what kind of things that you sort of took away from their exchanges and their little couple drama that they have going on. Mitch?
No, I was going to talk more about Freddy Krueger.
Well, you can do that, too.
I think that they actually were taking, like, a direct homage to Freddy Krueger from The Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh, they were.
From the fact that, like, well, even more than, oh, he looks like him. Because I think that they even had scenes. I watched the original movie a little bit ago. And they had a scene in, like, a basement where Freddy Krueger is kind of, like, scraping his claws along the wall. Kind of like he is when he's trying to go get the kids and whatnot. And I guess he's wearing the hat, too, and that gives it away like that. I was just confused why, if he's going to be, like, a Freddy Krueger kind of character, why he would have, like, those eye suckers. It just seemed random. Because that's not... Because Freddy Krueger...
To avoid copyright infringement, Mitch.
Well, it gets even creepier.
He wasn't too similar.
Yeah, probably. It gets even creepier because I'm pretty sure in the... There's two different canons of Freddy Krueger. In the old one, he was an alleged child rapist. But in the new canon, in the Wes Craven reboot that he did before he passed, he created the story to actually have that happen. Like, that was part of what happened in the plot. So, I mean, take that as you will, but the fact that he's going after little children, this makes it even creepier, knowing that he's meant to be, like, a Freddy Krueger kind of character, and that's what really creeped me out here, that he was, like, you know, chasing them down in the basement, and then, I mean, the way the kids were screaming when that was all happening, it was just all pretty terrifying.
That scene where little Buffy watches her cousin die, that was brutal. Like, that was more brutal than I remember it being.
Yeah. That was rough to get through. You can see why Buffy doesn't like to go to the hospital.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. That little girl, by the way, looks nothing like Buffy. I'm sorry.
Didn't know who those two little girls were first. I was so confused.
The other one was Buffy.
By the end of the episode, I put it together. But, man, I was so confused the first couple of those flashbacks.
Yeah, it's so funny. You know what is so funny? That girl, the actress, baby Buffy, she's our age now. I think she was born in like 1990 or something like that. So think about that.
Getting back to like Xander and Cordelia, who their interaction in this episode was so interesting. I loved that Cordelia finally kind of almost told Xander off about his whole like Buffy fixation. Like prior to now, yes. Kind of just existed in the same world as this Xander who makes these comments about Buffy shouldn't be interested in Angel, and like she just kind of plays him off because she's Cordelia and she doesn't care. And I loved how here she managed to kind of poke at Xander, like, I notice. Like, I might not say anything and I might not make a big deal out of it, but I do see it and you need to stop being weird. I love that she finally found an opportunity to kind of call him out on it. And so that was really, really a nice moment for her in addition to all of the work she got to do in this episode and things she got to take part of.
Yeah, And that's also, I think it's another way that I think Buffy does something so interesting with Xander and Buffy and Willow and Cordelia, and is that Xander's fixation on Buffy is really becoming a problem for him. He's getting better at handling it, but now he's with Cordelia, and Cordelia is fantastic and such a great character in her own right, and she's beginning to care for him now. So what's he gonna do? Like, suddenly it's not like these two equally antagonistic characters are coming at each other. It's like Xander's feelings for Buffy are not just affecting Xander and Buffy and Willow, it's also affecting Cordelia now, and just creating so much tension on the side. And thank God that Cordelia is the type of person that she is, because she's clearly like too good for for all of them. I just love her, guys. I'm sorry. She's just too good for Xander in that way, so she can sort of rise above it. But I think the same as you, Kristen. I really enjoyed her calling him out on it and sort of taking the first steps towards saying, look, this is like something that you need to deal with, because it's not okay for you to keep doing this and also be dating me. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's mm-hmm. it's so awkward in the best way. These teenagers' lives are so entangled and awkward.
I love this slow build of her coming into the group that continues even now, where she is clearly cemented into this group. Like, she's part of the gang. She might not be super close to, like, Buffy and Willow, but she's there and they've had their moments together, which can be really sweet moments or really funny moments, because she's great for the comedic relief. What I really like is the scene where, like, she's mad at Xander and yet she comes back to the hospital and gives him donuts and coffee, and like, she's there for him. Like, it's not out of jealousy. That's really clear. She is jealous, but she does it for him, and because she knows that he's going to be there and he should probably have that support. So it's really nice to see that. But also her with the monster and doing the research, like, she's so into it, you guys. Like, she loves it so much. And she, like, she's so curious about everything, and she takes over the phone to talk to Buffy, and she blames them for getting her all wrapped up in this. But she is, like, in it, and she loves it so much. And I think that is such a huge change from the Cordelia we saw in season one in particular, because she didn't really care about anything. She was very superficial, and I think maybe underneath this is really who Cordelia is, but she never let anybody see that. And now she's still kind of fighting it, but it's so clear how into it she is. And I think it's just great that Cordelia, you know, the queen bee, the person who doesn't necessarily want to be hanging out with these losers in her mind, kind of can't help herself because she loves it so much.
Yeah. And that's, again, that's one of the fantastic things about Cordelia. She genuinely, she has found something, like you said, to care about. And that's sort of, it's an interesting situation for her particularly too, compared to everyone else, because Willow and Xander and Giles are ultimately there for Buffy. You know, they got drawn into this because of Buffy. Cordy doesn't particularly like Buffy, but she hangs around because of the quote-unquote mission. You know, she's there legitimately to she's not actually fighting the demons, but she's there to help. She says it too, like, a couple of times, and I feel like the other characters don't really take her seriously. But as the audience, we're beginning to realize that, okay, now she's beginning to care about Xander, and she's had a few bonding moments with Willow, but ultimately, she's not there for the people. She's there for the fight, you know, more than the others are. And I don't think she gets enough credit for that, certainly not from the other characters in the show. And that's one of the reasons I find her so enjoyable, like, her earnestness and then her sheer just blatant honesty that we'll get to in my favorite quote. I enjoy, and that, like, her alone again makes this episode worth watching for sure. And so, but I mean, the rest of the episode, just Buffy, you know, makes herself sick to kill the sickness monster. They have some invisible fight scenes that look kind of cheesy, but were also kind of fun to watch. And we have the situation of Buffy in a vulnerable state, seeing a bit of her pre-Sunnydale life, which also isn't something that we get a lot of, so that was kind of a rare gem, even though it didn't feel like Buffy at all, because it didn't look like her at all. And yeah, I mean, maybe you're right. Maybe I won't skip this one on my next rewatch. Let's say it that way.
I feel so proud.
Be that far. Did we have anything else that was important to state this week? Like, was there any takeaways? Did you guys think anything was particularly noteworthy?
there are a lot of good child actors. I was really impressed by everyone that had a line that was, like, under the age of 10. I thought they did a good job conveying horror.
Yeah.
I did kind of have one issue with this episode. Buffy could see this, like, guy, but all of the rest of the people who could see this villain were, like, 10 or, like, 7. So I had some issues with why she could see him. Did I miss something?
It was just because she got that flu. Like, that was what made invisible. And she got the same string of flu as the kids. And maybe that's because she's, like, 17 or whatever, so she can still get, like, child's flu or whatever. She's, like, right on the cusp of adulthood or something. So that was the reason given.
I must have just missed. Okay, good. All right. Yeah. That works for me.
It's fine. Like, you were probably looking away.
Right. I had some issues following this episode because there was so much of it that I watched from behind my hands. I screamed for Karen to enter the room so that I could watch it because watching it by myself was not working. So yeah.
She made me turn on the light, for real.
Yeah. I'm not even kidding. It was scarring. Wow. But yeah. Okay, that makes more sense.
Okay, I'm sorry that scared you so much.
I also really like the moment between Willow and Giles where Willow's like, Buffy could actually be seeing this. And Giles is like, yeah, but, you know, she could be projecting or whatever. And it didn't feel like anyone was blaming Buffy or that they were thinking she was taking things out of context. They were, like, seriously discussing the potential of it going one way or another. And I like that it kind of, it helped the plot because it leads you to believe the doctor's behind it all. But in the end, like, Buffy was right. And it just, I like those moments where they kind of have to be like, well, you know, Buffy is a little messed up. Like, let's not forget she's died. She's gone through a lot of things. Like, sometimes she could be wrong. And that's a good thing to have in your hero because it makes them flawed and real. But on the other hand, like, this is the Hellmouth. Anything is possible. And so just to kind of keep that in mind, I think it's important for them to bring it up every once in a while. It's not always like, okay, you know, here's the setup. Buffy sees something. They research it. Here's the monster. They learn how to defeat it. It kind of, it got there eventually, but in a little more of a complex way. I don't want to say convoluted because I like the way that they did it.
That's a really good point. I mean, that's one of the things Buffy does is sort of the characters actually think things through and they don't always reach the right conclusion, but you sort of feel satisfied in that they're not, it's not convoluted. Exactly. It is complex, but it's never like they're snaking their way around the right answer because they need a story. And I like that. And I think that that episode did that really well. Mitch, what is your favorite scene?
My favorite scene is, and this makes me sound really sick, Buffy's cousin's death scene. And it's not because I'm like, yay, rooting for her to die. It's because I thought that she was a really convincing child actor. As I was saying, some of the other kids did a really good job, but this little bit is a standout scene from the fact that I felt like she was, I mean, horribly so, a little girl literally dying right there on screen. It felt so real. Like, the way she was screaming and how terrified her eyes were. It was just horrible. I hated seeing it, but I was so impressed that I hated seeing it as much as I did.
Yeah, that's true. It was good. And we have some positive Xander stuff happening too. Karen, what was yours?
I loved when Xander stands up to Angel because he kind of really shouldn't. Like, Angel could destroy him, but at the same time, it's nice to see Xander being super logical about it. And I mean, yeah, I guess there is some issue, like Angel probably could go kill everybody, but that would make the situation a lot more, it would make it more difficult for everybody, I think. And Angel isn't really up to that task right now. He would rather just torture Buffy in a more like mental way. And yeah, I mean, Xander clearly afterwards has a little moment and he's terrified. But I just like that he wasn't going to let Angel just walk right in there.
I have to agree. I think that Xander is the things that he does, despite having any power whatsoever, is pretty great sometimes. And this is definitely an example of that. And what about you, Kristen?
I loved the bit in the basement with Xander watching Buffy fight this invisible monster because you could easily think that she had lost her mind, but he was fully on her side and believed her despite not really knowing everything about this invisible creature. And just that scene, watching her fight it's hilarious because you're watching it from his point of view, but he believes her. And I just love how Xander is, you know, he can be a real idiot sometimes, but when he's fully on Team Scooby Gang, like when he's fully on Team Buffy, he's really, really sweet about it. And, you know, he's dedicated. And I thought that scene was just another little, you know, bit of Xander being the dedicated member of the team.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a good point about Xander. And just, you know, from, I know we don't have this one in our listener feedback, but I feel like our listener Melissa sums him up so well when she says, like, Xander makes some spectacularly bad choices, but he's human. And Joss Whedon sort of made him to represent a human being. So that means he has good sides and bad sides. And I think this is definitely his bravery and his loyalty really stands out, you know, in moments like these. And the way he's just so rooting for Buffy in such a non-diluted way, you know, and partly because he's, you know, obsessed with her, but partly because he genuinely, like, is rooting for her to succeed in everything she does. And I just, yeah, that was fun. And obviously just fun to see her fighting an invisible person, because it fun choreography there, I think.
And a lot less scary. I'd rather her fight the invisible bad guy than have to see him.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh. Well, my favorite scene was, just bringing it back to Cordy, is Giles and Cordelia's library scene, because not only was it hysterical because she keeps going like, ooh, what's that do? Ooh, what's that do? And Giles is just losing. Like, I feel like between Xander and Cordy, like, Giles is just losing his mind. But then also because she actually is the one that solves the thing. You know, she's actually the one that saves the day in a way with her research skills. And I appreciated seeing that and getting to see her shine like that. I guess just moving on from that, staying on the Cordy track, me and Karen have the same line. So I'll do the first one. You can take the follow-up one. But at some point, you know, Cordy is making one of her comments about not bringing gifts or whatever it is. And she and they're like, Cordelia, have you even heard of tact? And Cordelia goes, tact is just not saying true stuff. I'll pass. I think this is probably a quote that people use to define Cordelia when they talk about her. She's like, that's like her, one of her iconic lines. I loved it. And then later in the episode, we're brought back
because Giles is like, why do I have to have Cordelia, is basically what he's going to say. And Cordelia just looks at him and goes, let's go, tact guy. Yeah. And I love this so much. On the one side, because, yeah, Cordelia is the one who says true stuff. Like, sometimes it's rude, sometimes it's not exactly true, but it's like her belief in it. And I really appreciate her for not dancing around it like the other characters do, because sometimes that's what Buffy in particular needs. Like, she needs to hear the truth and kind of get over herself sometimes. But also clearly here, when she goes, let's go, tact guy, she's been listening. She's been paying attention. She's not stupid. She knows the situation, and she just kind of rolls with it anyway. And it's really great.
Yeah, absolutely. All the love for Cordy. And Kristen, what's yours?
Mine is between Xander and Buffy as they're kind of heading off to go kill this thing. And Xander says, you don't know how to kill this thing. And Buffy says, I thought I might try violence. And he goes, solid call. it's she's always got that in her back pocket. Buffy kicks ass.
Yeah. That brings it back to like an earlier scene when she's, or episode where she's like, I don't always use violence. And they all just like look at her like, yeah, you do.
Yeah.
And what's yours, Mitch?
Mine's when Buffy's about to take the flu serum and she goes, I'm doing this, Willow. And you can't stop me. And then Willow's like, Buffy, that's 100% pure. It'll kill you in an instant. And Buffy just goes, oh, they surely put that on the label. And it's like, they're not really going to expect people to drink it straight out of the thing. Come on.
Mm-hmm. I was calling dubious science on this time around, but I think it's because I'm so used to shows today taking a lot more care to make it more realistic. But it was funny anyway.
Mm-hmm. I liked it a lot. And yeah, that wraps up Killed by Death. Shorter discussion than Passion, but it was also less impactful in the show overall, so that kind of fits. Now we're going to move on to some listener feedback before we end the show. And again, if you want to send in your spoiler-free comments, email us, rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. tweet us at re_watchable, find this post on hypable.com, and find us on rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com. So our iTunes reviews, if you rate us 5 stars, then Karen will bring you a puppy to eat because she is so sweet.
Aww.
I still can't get over the fact that Spike didn't kill the puppy. Like, oh, I feel God. Like maybe they just couldn't do that on TV, but I feel like that's, like, important.
You know? Well, I will say, when she walked in with the puppy, I said, Spike, I swear to God, if you drink the puppy, you're off. You're on my shit list. Like,
You can never forgive him for that, right?
Right. And he doesn't. So I was like, all right. You know, you can continue to be funny, Spike. That's fine.
Yeah. I agree. I really agree. I feel like that would have been a turning point for him, and that didn't happen. I mean, he's obviously super evil, but as Ariana said, you know, he's a super bad vampire too. So I feel like that made sense. So we have a lot of tweets. Mitch, you want to get the first one?
So our friend Gordon at Toonie Chopper Man wrote, "The next episode is really hard to watch on hashtag National Puppy Day, or any day, to be honest. The trauma is real."
Mm-hmm. Speaking of puppies.
Poor Sunshine. I wonder what happened to Sunshine. I also wonder what happened to the pig and the fish. Well, I know what happened to the fish. I saw that. So I'm adding Sunshine onto the list. And
I'm sure Sunshine got away because Spike wasn't hungry. So Drew was like, I'll just let him run around. And he found a hole and escaped. And
but Drew Spike was like, whatever. She also didn't feed her bird. We can add that bird onto the list. This show is the bird not nice to animals.
Nope. That's true. So, Lucy W. asks, can you guys remind us who the newbies and the rewatchers are? Some newbie predictions sound like they're spot on. Ooh, they're good for you guys. Correct me if I'm wrong. I believe that the superfans are me, Karen, Caitlin, and Natalie, and the newbies are Kristen, Mitch, Ariana, and Brittany. Yes? That's all of us? Yeah.
And Each episode, the show notes has who the newbies and the superfans are. So if you get confused, feel free to check that out.
Yes. And that doesn't mean you can necessarily tell who's who, but...
True.
Hopefully
that's what the fun facts are for.
Our fun facts in the beginning, we should say our name, and then we should say superfan or newbie, so that anyone just tuning in for a specific episode, even if they're not, like, following everything, you know? Like, what if someone wanted to come in just for a passion today? Then they would want to know who the newbies
are. No, they'd have no idea who Mitch was. It's like,
which is a shame. I have to admit, they should know who I am by now. I'm not famous.
Yeah. You're like the Mitch, yeah. Karen and Kristen and Mitch, do you guys just want to get the last three tweets?
Yes. So Mandy K says, "You guys are the best part of my Mondays. Thanks for being awesome." This means so much because I feel like we put a lot of time and effort into this podcast, and I love it so much. So I'm glad that listeners are feeling the love, and they like it as well. And also, Mandy K has a lot of great tweets. Sometimes she tweets me, sometimes it's just at Rewatchable, but she has a lot of really funny thoughts and thoughtful things to say. So thank you.
Aw. Maria Lovegood had a question for us, and she said, "Am I the only one that thought in 2x16, Cordy was not affected by the spell because she already loved Xander?" Interesting thought. I don't think I ever went there, but, you know, it could be the reason. I know in the episode Giles says it's because the necklace was hers, so she was the only one immune because of that, but it would have been a nice little touch.
I've thought about this a couple of times, but ultimately, like, I think I replied on Twitter too that Willow loves him too, and she's very affected. And then Mariah, she replied, and she went, well, she sees Willow's as more of an infatuation, but I think Willow genuinely loves him. Like, obviously this is up for interpretation, but I think that Willow's love for him is at this point more genuine than Cordelia's, because that's just kind of beginning to spark. Like, ooh, maybe I like him as more than just a kissing buddy, you know?
Willow's might be more of a, we know each other inside and out, we've been friends forever kind of love. Mm. Like, not necessarily in love, but she loves him.
I mean, she said as much in the episode, you know, and I know she was under the spell, but I feel like it brought out, like, it was so intense for her because the feelings were already there.
Yeah.
Poor Willow. Oh, my gosh.
This is the classic Marius and Eponine. What can we say?
Well, speaking of poor Willow, one of the earliest plans for this episode for Passion was to kill Oz instead of Jenny. And then they were like, you know, I mean, this was all planned before they even, I think, started filming the season. But they were like, yeah, we can kill Oz. And then they were like, no, Oz is amazing. We can't do that.
We can't kill Oz. So hashtag Jenny. Don't kill Oz.
Yeah, exactly. And the final comment, Mitch?
Sure, from Cherie Smith. I'm so grateful there's at least two people on the rewatch still on Xander's side. I love flawed characters trying to be better. Do not count me amongst them, Cherie. I am sorry to report that, but not really. I don't
count me amongst them, Cherie. Selena, we'll get. We have to end soon, but we'll have to get into this because I wasn't on the last episode, and I am. Have some stuff to say, but we do have some two kind of different opinions on Xander's episode in the comments for last week's rewatchable, which was obviously the discussion on Bewitched, Bothered, and Bewildered. Who wants that one? The all caps comment.
I'll read it.
Okay.
I don't necessarily agree with it, but I'll read it, because everybody's entitled to their opinion. I hate Xander says, that episode was disgusting, just like Xander. I'm sorry, but I don't excuse his actions just because he's a teenage boy. I'm a teenage girl, and if I ever do something as bad as this, I want to get punished. I want to have consequences for my decisions. Being young or being a boy doesn't and shouldn't give you an excuse for this kind of thing. And why is it that teenage girls are made to feel ashamed of being teenage girls, but being a teenage boy means that you get a free pass even when you're a horrible person? By the way, I love you all as hosts, even when I find you annoying.
Melissa, Karen, do you want to get that one?
Sure. Melissa says, I'm having a moral crisis here, guys. I wasn't really bothered by many of Xander's issues you brought up. I feel like I should be. You made some excellent points on the podcast, but after rewatching Bewitched, Bothered, and Bewildered, I was actually just expecting the newbies to enjoy the comedy of the episode. I think I'm not taking Xander seriously. I've mentally shut out any feelings about what he does and enjoy him for the comedy he brings. Is that horrible? I'm thinking it probably is. Although I've watched this quite a few times, the first time being quite a few years ago, I'm certainly curious how I'd feel about him if I was just watching it now for the first time.
And that brings up an interesting point, too, because I feel like if this show was made today, Xander's character would be handled a lot differently simply because of the backlash that they might get from the vocal online fandom, you know? And I mean, yeah, again, we have to end this podcast soon, but I feel like the thing about a show like Buffy, not only was it made in a pre-super aware social media time, but it was also made from a place where the writers wanted to tell stories about complicated characters. You know, I feel like today you see a lot of characters that are there to represent something, and it's very we're very quick to sort of say, "Ooh, that's a negative representation of something," or that sends the wrong messages. And I'm not saying necessarily that this doesn't, because if you feel like it does, then, you know, it does in that sense. But I think when I watch Xander on screen, I mean, it's not that I'm not bothered by the things he does and says, but I think I know that the writers are doing it on purpose. Xander is written to be a teenage boy, and he's written to be selfish, and there's no obligation from the writers to make him stand for something. Like Xander's there to be, for lack of a better word, and I don't like this word, but quote-unquote problematic, you know, like problematic. It's such an easy blanket word to throw out there, but he's there, as Melissa says in a comment too, he's there to be human. He's there to prove, like most characters on Buffy, he represents the in-between space between good and evil. He's not there to be a hero. He's not there to be morally sound. He's there to show that you can have good sides and bad sides. And you, the audience, like all science fiction, you're sort of invited to evaluate your own morality through his choices, even especially when they are bad choices. And I think the thing that is could be an issue here is the way that the characters sort of brush off what he did. At the same time, I will say that the commenter that calls themselves I Hate Xander says, you know, oh, if this had been a girl, it would have been different. I don't think it would. Like, imagine this episode, but if Willow had done it, and imagine how the other characters would have reacted to that. I think it would have been exactly the same. And I think it's because they recognize that, I mean, Xander was acting out of a selfish impulse, but he was not doing reproachable, you know what I mean? I don't want to keep talking about this, but I feel like it's important just to remember that Xander is there to be flawed. And yeah, if he's flawed and if you have a problem with him, that's okay, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and in the episode, I mean, Giles is beyond pissed, like, yeah, and he doesn't hide it at all. So like, no one in the episode makes it at all acceptable that Xander has done this. Like, they cannot believe he went this far. And so, you know, I feel like that goes a long way telling, you know, the audience exactly how bad Xander screwed up here. And even Xander knows it. Like, the next day after, he knows that he screwed up.
Right. Like, Giles is always my measure. The way he reacts to Xander is kind of how I expect that's our moral. Giles is in a lot of way our moral compass, even though he makes mistakes. But Buffy is also an exercise in the characters forgiving each other for their mistakes. You know, that goes a lot further than just Xander. And I don't know, Karen, if you want to add something to that. But these are all flawed people who need forgiveness for stuff that they do, you know?
Yeah. No, I think I'm pretty much in line where you are, honestly.
And I don't know, Mitch, do you want to add something? Or
I have a lot of feelings about Xander that won't fit in this podcast. I don't agree that he should be forgiven for being a teenage boy. I understand that the perspective can be presented that way. I have never subscribed to that. I've always been against Xander's blatant disregard for the morality of a situation and for the care he needs to take toward other human beings. I think he can often be a very disgusting person. I don't think that's exclusive to being a teenage boy. I think that that's exclusive to being a Xander. I don't care for this character anymore. And after Bewitched, I can't redeem him in my eyes. He's dead to me as a character, and this sounds so horrible, but I mean it. I really can't wait for this character to just finally exit the show, whether it's he's going to die eventually or the actor wants to leave. I'm not a fan of him, and I really can't even think about him sometimes. It gets me that angry.
I feel like when I watch my favorite shows, it's very hard for me to stay feeling one way about characters. I feel like the best shows that I've ever watched have set up a character and then Not in a huge way, not with a huge, big, heroic, I'm going to change everything about myself moment, but just by slowly changing the situations around them, changing dynamics, changing whatever happens, like my attitude slowly shifts. I think a really good example is Kane from The 100. You know, like he never necessarily redeems himself for what he did, but he does some things now that gives me on his side. And I don't know if you've watched The 100, Mitch, but it's one of those. It's also Battlestar Galactica is another great example of characters that are legitimately morally ambiguous. Like, you cannot get behind some of the things they do, but stuff happens in the show where you have to go, okay, well, they are in this horrible situation, they're dealing with these things, I have to be open to them doing things. Like Xander is for sure selfish, and he's for sure doesn't think his things through, and he's for sure, like, again, he keeps going on about this thing for Buffy. He is, and you, again, you'll see him, like, make some terrible choices, but the thing is that he is there to make those terrible choices, but also to make some good choices. He's there to do bad things, and he's there to do some good things. I think writing him off and sort of putting him into a box, I mean, do whatever you want, obviously, it's you're watching it, but putting him into a box and trying to keep him there for the rest of the show will really take away some of that nuance that is there, and that is partly there to showcase what it means to be human and what it means to be a flawed human. You, I don't think you'll find a Buffy fan who doesn't think that Xander is flawed. But you will also find Buffy fans that watch him grow, you know?
I find it hard to swallow ever saying that he's simply just a flawed character and one that will make good choices and bad choices, and that's how we're going to learn how to respect him. I think that there is a certain low point of morality that he's reached to the point where he believed it would be okay to spell Roofie, a woman, and of course
that's not what he did, though. Okay, well, anyway, we're getting into, but that is,
and I think it's important to me to keep him in that box, because if I knew him personally as a person, I would never forgive him for this, and I don't know how Buffy reacted the way she did, praising him for not continuing on and having sex with her, and we can debate whether or not that's rape, I guess. I don't like Xander. He's a very difficult character for me to swallow now after Bewitched, and I think it's going to be very hard to convince me that whatever he does good and positive past this will ever redeem him from that episode and from other actions he continues to do, like not leaving Buffy alone when she's clearly not interested in him. It's just, or maybe she is now. I don't know. She shouldn't be, in my opinion. And I understand, Selena, that you and I are definitely on odds about the circumstances for which, you know, Xander can or can't be judged. I understand your perspective, too.
Yeah, of course. I mean, absolutely. And that's, again, just to wrap this up, it is important because I do feel like, for me, just in general, these shows, like, I don't hold an opinion of a character from, like, the first season and a half. Like, I just don't, because you never know what's going to happen and you never know what, like, how the constellations are going to change. But no, the Xander debate is definitely an interesting one, and I think it says a lot about the time in which we're watching this and the conversations that's going on about television in general and our sort of increased awareness on entertainment influence. And that is interesting, and it's going to be interesting to watch going forward. But I just want to emphasize that the writers were intention, like, they are not, the writers are not glorifying Xander, but they are setting up characters that are flawed. I'm gonna have to hold you to this, Mitch. Like, if you're gonna put Xander in this box because he's done this unforgivable thing, then there's gonna be some characters that I'm gonna ask you to keep in boxes too, and I'm gonna expect you to do that, because if that's the measure. But anyway, it'll be interesting.
Listen, I know you also don't agree with this. This is my opinion. If any character magic roofies anyone, I will absolutely put them in a box. 10,000%. Until then, they can stay out of that box. They really can.
Okay. Listeners, if you have thoughts on Xander or anything else that we've talked about this episode, I feel like this could easily turn into the Xander cast if we don't remember that this is about Buffy the Vampire Slayer. You can, as I said before, you can email us, you can tweet us, you can find this post on HiPeople.com, where all the contact information is, and you can find us on Tumblr, rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com. We really look forward to hearing from you. And that's it. Oof, we have a lot to think about. This is exciting. I love those kind of conversations. I honestly do. Until next week, where we'll be talking about, is that I Only Have Eyes for You? Is that the next one? And then Go Fish?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Have fun with those ones.
We have more about Selena. Fish. Come on, wasn't stringing the fish enough?
Leave the gonna fish be a common alone. Theme.
Leave the fish alone. What did they do?
Yeah, well, you'll see next week when we get back for that. Until next week, my name is Selena.
I'm Karen.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Mitch.
And that's the end. Yay!
Bye!
Bye, everyone! What do you feel about it, Karen? If you're still there. She doesn't feel anything. Karen, are you there? Karen!
Kristen, she went run over there and hit her with a shoe. Maybe she's dead. Maybe Angel got to her.
Oh my god, don't say that.
That is not even close to
that's
okay.
Awful.
Because that also means that he's in my apartment.
Oh yeah, that means he's coming after true. You.
So let's not go there.
You're not.
We can't hear you.
Did you push the button to mute your microphone by accident, maybe?
No, there's...
Oh, wait. Someone's typing. You're typing. Wait, we can hear you type.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Now we can.
That was so weird. Nothing changed. I mean, I unplugged passion. My mic and put it back in, but...
When your mic isn't working and you really want to speak.
Did you hear Mitch, like, suggest that Angel had killed you?
Yeah, I heard everything.
Sorry.
Are you Mitch?
That's awful. Oh my gosh.